The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Experience lightning fast speeds and Sky's best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, with gyms reopening and more people getting active outdoors, personal trainer Carl Henry joined me in studio to talk about keeping fit and doing it safely. Miriam Brady and Ronan Smith have been at the heart of the Irish entertainment world for many years, and Miriam told me how life has changed for them as she finds herself stepping into the role of her husband's carer after Ronan's diagnosis with early onset Alzheimer's. The Euro 2020 tournament was brought to a standstill on Saturday following the collapse of Christian Eriksen when he suffered a cardiac arrest. And former Irish international footballer Clive Clark spoke to me about watching those all too familiar scenes. And Cork native Kian McCarthy told me about leaving BlackRock for Broadway and his extraordinary career as musical director for The Book of Mormon and Moulin Rouge and what it was like to play piano for the world premiere of Hamilton. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. It's obviously not just the pubs and the restaurants that have opened. The gyms have opened too. And of course, everyone's got to be COVID compliant and very safe. A lot of summer outdoor spending time to be going on, according to advice. That's why we asked Carl Henry to come along in studio to talk about easing back into the gym, if that's your thing. And any thoughts on that? 51551. Carl, good to see you as always.
Good morning. How are you? How's it going?
I'm good. Now, I didn't mention to people, but I'll tell them now, because off air, it was you who suggested when I was saying I was heading away because I was talking to you. In a different world, and you said you should try to go climb Carrin Tuathail. Why would you say something like that to somebody like me?
Well, you made it sound so easy. I was listening before I came in. You're like, oh, you know, climb Carrin Tuathail, came down, drove home, had an amazing sleep.
I did.
You know, people around the country who'd be raring to go. I suppose that we were having a chat and I said, listen, well, you're down that neck of the woods. Why not try something totally random, totally crazy, but really phenomenal, for want of a better word? Because it's there. It's on our doorstep. We drive past these mountains all the time. We look at them and think, God, wouldn't it be great? You've done it and you did it. Now, it is important to tell people you do have to exercise to get fit to do it. Yes. You do have to get a guide, ensure all the safety protocols are there. But what an amazing feeling. And, you know, again, you made it sound very easy. It's 3,407 feet and 6 whole inches of height. You climbed it. And what comes from that is achievement. And a sense of, can I do it? The nervousness build, particularly for yourself, because you publicly announced it.
Yeah, you know, that was my first mistake.
Can it be done?
Because I couldn't get out.
Am I setting myself up to fail? Or, you know.
Yeah.
And then when you conquer it, the feel-good kick from that, like you're a week later, you're still very high
still
over the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the beauty of it. And it's using your body, using your health to do things that are on our doorstep, that it's there. And so few people have climbed these mountains, and they are there. And the feeling from, whether it's the Sugarloaf, whether it's Carrin Tuathail, whether it doesn't matter, it's climbing the mountain, getting to the top, that sense of achievement and what that does for your overall health, your mental health, your physical health, your emotional health.
Yes.
It's transformative.
Yes.
And what happens then is you're like, right, where's the next one?
Yeah. We'll get to that in about an hour. There is that. I was laughing earlier on about the metaphorical climb of the mountain, but there is something. And maybe it was after COVID and it was, you know, such a strain on people, including myself, you know, for different reasons. And you just think, God, you know, maybe I needed something as off the ball as this challenge. I don't know why. You think you'd had a challenge, you know, that things are the way they are. But I'm still not sure why I bothered my derriere to do it, but it felt very good, I'll be honest with you.
If nothing else, I think we've realised life is short. And what a tough. And I was out of Dublin for the first time at the weekend in ages. Yeah. And just driving on my own, you reflect on the 6 months, particularly that we've been through the winter lockdown. It's been so difficult.
Yeah.
Now is the time to get out, to get active. And Carrin Tuathail, you know, it's a euphemism. It's you know, that could be, for some people, it could be walking to the shop. It could be, it doesn't have to be the biggest mountain in Ireland. Yeah. Everyone has their own version of it.
Yes.
And that's, people listening in, that's the thing to take from it. It's the, can I do something, trying to work for that or train for that and then completing it.
Yeah.
And then you get into the cycle of health, because it's not boring anymore. It's fascinating because my body can do this. I'm able to do this. And you build upon it. And, you know, with gyms are back open. And it is important to set some targets and set some goals. Yeah. But, you know, work towards something. Use your bodies for what they can do, because they can do amazing things.
Being relatively fit helps, and you know, I did a bit, I keep an eye on myself in this regard. You know what I mean? So it's not just that I said I'll just lash up to
and
the
I
top
think,
of the
and that
the
is
back.
Important,
and it
and
really
yeah.
did help enormously. I think you're right. You can't just say, "Oh, did you just do that?" No, I mean, I would have been prepared for it physically.
Correct. Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing, right? So say if you are listening and you want to climb Cairns, great. You know, don't just rock up if you've been sitting on your bum for the last 12 months over COVID watching the box sets such as the US office. You got to exercise. You got to get fit to do it and then get a guide. I know, it's, you know, someone texted in, I think, earlier on who said that the guide was going to, they booked a guide to bring you up. Do that.
Yeah.
It might cost you whatever the price is. It'll cost you less than a night out, less than a meal out. And they'll give you not just the safety element, but the stories and the history and the sense of romance that comes from climbing things like
that's
these.
That's a great,
you know?
Romance is a good word too, because it is so rugged and beautiful. And now we got up and it was cloudy. It was really, really wet. And it was not that it wasn't nice. The conditions weren't friendly. They were inclement conditions. But that attitude, like that challenge, and you knew that you were, the rain was hitting your face like you were being punched. And I just thought, that's what it's all about.
There's something about, you know, human versus nature. And it's lovely, and I love exercising. And I would say that I'm the trainer guy, but I love exercising when the weather is really bad. You know, safety is important, and I know the areas that I exercise in. But there is that sense of, everything's against me here. Can I do this? And can I conquer it? And that applies to any form of exercise, whether it's weight loss, whether it's going for a walk, if you're very sedentary, whether it's building up your fitness for a 5K, whether it's climbing a mountain. It's the same sense of, can I do it? And the self-belief, I can do something. And that spreads to all aspects of your life then, not just that one bit. And that's the power of it, of setting a goal, working towards it and completing that goal, relevant of the goal. So some people are listening in, you know, use your bodies. Set a goal that works for you. Whatever your Cairn Toohill is, if it is it, great, do it. If it's, you know, walking to the shop for the first time and leaving the car at home and that being a struggle, well, it's going to get easier with practice. And don't be afraid of it, because, you know, that with yourself, there was a sense of, can I do it? Well, that's the best bit. If I sign up for a marathon or an ultra or whatever, can I do something? Yes or no?
There's
that sense of, you know, yeah, can I or can't I? And that's really, there's something very powerful about that.
I nearly didn't do it, you know. The night
you had every
before,
excuse.
I got a call to say, you know, the weather's not going to be great. Maybe wait for a couple of days. And I thought, well, I won't be here in a couple of days. So I just thought, no. Actually, the lovely people who took me up, Maddie and Morris, were so good. They got in touch with us through the show to say, we'll take you up the mountain and down again. Maddie joins us now. Good morning, Madeline.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
How are you today?
I'm very good.
So when I got to the car park in, wasn't it Fossey Church?
It was in Fossa.
Fossa, rather. Church, yeah. And Fossa Church. Fossey Bear. I'm getting mixed up. Fossa Church. And you were there and your dad had met me in Killorglum. And we got to meet you guys in the car park there. And I think the nicest thing was that you looked at me in my jeans and shirt and trousers or whatever shoes I was wearing. You thought, certainly your dad thought, and where's the gear? I said, is this tote not enough? I mean, there was laughter. There was mockery in the air. But you very kindly reached into the boot and took out everything I needed and said, there's a church there, there's a loo there, get changed. And, you know, were you worried by the sight of me that morning, Madeline?
I wasn't worried, no. You may have been a little bit unprepared, but we had everything for you. So in regards to fitness, and you mentioned that you do a lot of walking, that I'm sure there was no problem.
Yeah, and then what about the weather? I know that your dad was in two minds the night before regarding the conditions or whatever. When we got up then and hit the clouds and the temperature dropped, and I'll never forget when we got to the top, the sandwiches that you very kindly were bringing out, and the bread was dribbling down my knuckles as the rain punched it out of my hand. I mean, were you worried about that?
So there was very strong winds and heavy rain when we got to the top, and it was challenging on the way up as well, but you fully embraced the elements when you were going up. But on the way down, it is very important to gauge the weather, and that way then when you have a guide and you're navigating, it is you know when to lay low and you know when to actually move on. And then when the clouds come down and things like that, it's very important as well to make sure that you don't travel the wrong route. But I think you did really well with the soggy sandwiches at the top as well.
Do you remember your dad was skipping down over those steps, that scree or whatever it's called, at one stage, and I was trying to follow him. And we were bouncing, you know, like...
The Fred Astaire walk.
The Fred Astaire. That's why I said your dad looked like Fred Astaire trying to kind of negotiate that. That was one of the most amazing sights I've seen. He was trying to overtake another party at that point. He's quite agile, isn't he?
Dad, he is fit as a fiddle.
Really is.
He is.
And what was one of the nice things about the trip up, because it was just the three of us, was it felt like... I've never done the Camino. But it felt like a kind of the Camino of Karen Tuchel, you know, where the conversation went all over the place in a really interesting way. And, you know, I felt we definitely got on very well. Well, I would say that anyway. But there was a good vibe and, you know, it was intriguing.
It was. It really ebbed and flowed. There was music, there was stories, there was
chocolate,
mythology. There was, do you know, when we're going up to the three tiers and then we had like, we always call it the breakfast table where we stop and we have a little break. And then that's before we head up Brother O'Shea's Gully. But it was a very intriguing day. It was like everything just flowed nicely.
Yeah. And when you pushed me into the car and said, get out, get out of Killarney, get out of Kerry, were you glad to see the back of me?
No, I'd love to
get out and
actually embrace Karen
Tuchel
on a sunny day.
I'd love that. Carl, you've climbed, obviously, Karen Tuchel a few times.
Yeah.
So what do you say to people who are listening in, apart from the fact that they should get in touch with our friends and mountain adventure walks and say, lads, help us up there, who would say, I wish I could do that?
I think people can do anything that they set their mind to. I suppose what I do for a living, I help people achieve those dreams and goals for things. The key thing, obviously, is safety, but it's about setting a target, setting a goal. Look around you. Like, exercise doesn't have to be boring. It's not the same old stuff anymore. Like, we've got amazing mountain biking trails. I was surfing down in Inchidani on Thursday. There's all the hill walking trails. Like, everything, it's on your doorstep. Look around you.
Yeah.
And take from that, when we were sitting at home in January and February, locked in, dreaming of doing wonderful things, those wonderful things are there. So set that target. Work towards it. If you need help, go and get it. Again, ask around locally, depending on what that goal may be. And then safety is really important. So, like, you know, mountaineering.ie is a really good website if it's water safety, if you're, you know, cold water swimming or anything like that, watersafety.ie. Get the safety advice and then get the expertise for, you know, mountains, getting a guide like, you know, you did then in Kerry. Perfect.
Yeah.
Because it, and as I said, you know, it's not, you can hear it in the chatting to Madeline there. It's having the crack.
Yes.
You had the crack. You had an experience. It wasn't just the mountain. It was the chats, the conversation, the food, the stories. And I use the word romantic. It's a romantic mindfulness moment because you don't think about anything else.
You just look
around you. You take it in, and that's it's very powerful to experience.
There were times, Madeline, the only thing I was thinking about was staying alive, which just don't die,
Madeline. Were there any really scary moments? That's what we all really want to know here. It all sounds very, very poetic. Fill us in on all the juicy gossip.
Well, there is always places where you have to scramble and be completely mindful, like, you know. The saying, it's like the body needs movement and the mind needs stillness, and nature gives that to you. So there's parts where you are focused on every step and every handhold on the way down and all the way up. Like coming down the Heavenly Gates, there's a section where you just turn into the wall and you come down safely. But like that, it's about just being mindful and being careful of the weather as well as every step you take.
Every step you take. That's a reading from the book of Sting there, Madeline. It's very nice to talk to you. Best to your dad.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
And we'll see you soon.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
thank you.
Madeline or Maddie Walsh joining us from Mountain Adventure Walks there. And herself and her dad were just the delightful hosts on the hill. Ryan and Carl, I'd love to be able to exercise, but recent health challenges meant that I can't, says Margaret. I loved walking and I've walked hundreds of miles and climbed mountains, but now 20 minutes is my limit. COVID has been a particular challenge as I'm unable to get on my feet and out of my head. Tricky one, that.
tricky one. I would say, you know, it's relative. Look around you. So maybe chat with your GP first and foremost. Always start there. What can I do? And find an exercise. So, and we do the Q&A on Instagram every week. We see people, you know, it's getting in touch like that. Find something you can do.
Yeah.
That could be some resistance training. So some body weight training. And as you get older, we need to do more of that. So even if sitting in a seat with two bottles of water or two dumbbells or two tins of beans, there's a whole series of, you know, exercises you can do there. Find something to do. Don't just sit, because that's what that texture says, for the mind.
Yes.
That's what we need to move for. It's that mental well-being, that emotional well-being. Movement will deliver that more than any drug known to mankind, and it's free. It's just by finding something you can do, and everyone has their own Karen tool. So find what yours is and find a way around it.
Sounds good. Noreen says, how did you train for the climb? I'm inspired to climb, but now... But how do I train? So maybe you can come in there.
Hill Walking Club is a great place to start. And they will welcome people of all levels of fitness, and they meet and everything's taken care of. You just turn up and you bring your sandwiches and your flask and your backpack and off you go. Starting with hills locally is, and a really hilly walking route is really good. And some lower body exercises, or so your squats, your lunges, things like that. Have a look at the Operation Transformation website. There's free exercise plans up on that.
And food plans.
That stays live all year round, and food plans. But the key thing there is, you know, get on Google, local hill walking club. Just put that in. They will welcome you. They love new people. And they take care of all of the scary stuff, which is, where do we go? What do we do? What do we need?
Okay, that's a good thing.
And
good
they will, they'll, it's a community. So you get to do it once a week or whatever, and it's fun.
Can you ask Carl how to lose my belly? I can look after my cardio by walking and running, but I can't get rid of my belly and waistband. I'm 43 years old, a woman with two kids, and I'm fit.
Brilliant question. It's the most popular question we get, particularly over COVID, people sitting
and
at home
and men have
more
bellies too that they're trying to get
rid of. Well, first of all, it's where your belly is, right? So I use belly button as that marker.
Yes.
Men tend to think it's lower and women tend to think it's higher, but the belly button, it's there. We know belly and health, in terms of the circumference and your health, are interlinked. High waistline, high risk. How do you get rid of it? It's multifactorial. That's not the politician's answer, but it is. So it's food, eating healthily, eating balanced. It's movement, so cardiovascular, and then resistance movement as well. Especially as we get older. So mid-30s onwards, the body begins to change. We need to do some resistance training. That sounds scary. It's not. It's body weight resistance. So it's squats, lunges, press-ups, planks, things like that. Sleep. Crucial. If your sleep is off and you're not sleeping well, your body was more prone to storing fat. So your sleep health is really important, as is your emotional and your mental health, which is why over COVID people have put more weight on their stomach area. The gut brain axis is, it's only really getting into the science of it now in terms of being discovered. So, but your mental health's important. So my point there is, it's, there's lots of different factors to losing your tummy. It's not sit-ups, they won't do anything for it. We all have a six pack. It's what covers it is the problem. So look at all those areas. Look at that multifactorial approach to your health, and then it takes time. Give it time.
Time, yeah, don't be in a rush. Yep. I'm heading to Donegal, says Katrina, for a few days. Having done Karen Toohill, how does Errigal compare?
You know what? That's one I actually haven't done.
Oh, what?
No, I know. I've done the four tallest,
like,
and I've done lots of other ones too. But the photographs, it looks amazing.
What's the one you were telling me to do next?
Steve Donard. So the four tallest are Lugnaquilla, Steve Donard, Karen Toohill, and Will Rhee up in Mayo. Prior to COVID, we would have taken corporate groups on like 3-day challenges of doing all four over 3 days and all that kind of stuff.
But Donard is the one.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, oh my God. And the history of it.
Lovely.
The Mourne Wall, the view. It's like Lord of the Rings up there. It is absolutely spectacular.
I've written it down. I have Tippex in case I need to get rid of it, but I have written it down. I started walking in lockdown one, and now my young lads are golfing in Paris Court, and I'm out walking and enjoying the fresh air instead of dropping them off and heading home. I'm delighted to hear Carl. I love his Instagram. He's an inspiration.
Oh my God, the pressure.
The pressure.
You know, it's the thing around that is, right, move. And the more, so for that person, they're dropping their children off to do something. You can sit in the car with your coffee. You can sit in the car and look at Instagram all day long. You can sit in the car and read the paper. The best thing you can do is get out of the car and move. That's one foot in front of the other. And
the
move.
Best advice you can offer
and
anyone.
And it sounds so
move.
Simple.
No, it's true.
But actually, we're conditioned to sitting as much as we can now. And
Morris from on the mountain, I was there, Madeline's father, was saying he's a great thing, which is sage advice, which was, he said, to be honest with you, I'm one of those people who keeps moving and thinking. Like, I know, saying, yeah, I've got that, I get that. And he said, I just don't put the TV on before 6 o'clock in the day. And I thought, that's pretty smart. Just don't put it on. If you, and if you turn it and say, so what do I do instead? Chances are you will have to move.
Yeah, you'll have to move. Like I was to the supermarket shopping yesterday. I'm fascinated. I look at stuff. I'm fascinated by people.
Yeah.
And as I was sitting in the car waiting to get out, you watch the cars and the cars go round the car park to get closest to the door of the supermarket.
Yeah.
And you're like, park further away and walk and lift the, you know, use your strength, lift the stuff. Yeah. Like
that's exercise.
People are fascinated.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But the key thing from catching up with you today is movement.
Yeah.
Get out and move. We live in an amazing country. Our bodies can do amazing things. It's all about self-belief and having a go and not being afraid.
Well, thank you. You, as Elvis would have said once, you gave me a mountain and I had a go. Carl Henry, great to see you.
You too.
Thanks for coming in today. And Carl Henry, and somebody mentioned Carl's Instagram, that Carl Henry PT is the Instagram site that if you want to follow Carl and his adventures in any given day, head there straight away. But now it's 9 minutes to 10. All right, at 9:27, I want to talk to you about Miriam Brady and Ronan Smith, a couple that have given plenty of us entertainment over the years, from Miriam's role in Glenroe to Ronan's work with Riverdance and in the Gaiety Theatre. They've been involved in really the Irish theatre industry and scene for many, many years. And Miriam is with us this morning.
Good
it's lovely
morning.
To meet you, Miriam.
How are you?
Thank you for coming in. I'm enjoying this new scene of having people in front of me in studio.
Yes, it must be amazing for you, actually.
Well, it is lovely. I'm particularly keen to talk to you this morning because of Ronan.
Yes.
Tell me about Ronan, will you?
Oh, well, subjectively, Ronan.
As much as you can.
Ronan is the best guy in the whole world. I met him in 1987 when I was an actor in Cork, and I was in Othello and he came to visit our company. He was working for a team theatre company. He was AD there. And as soon as I saw him, this sounds very strange, but I absolutely fell in love with him. And I turned to my friend and I said, oh dear, that's the man I'm going to marry.
Really?
Across a crowded room. And of course, I just put that away because one does. That's just silly talk and you get on with your life. And he went back to Dublin and I got on with my life. And I continued my acting career, and then I took a break and I went to Kenya to work on the missions there and came back. And then I got a call from Team Theatre Company asking me to audition. And I, long story short, went to work with Team, fell in love with Ronan. 2 years later, we were married.
And I think it's amazing that you'd spot this man.
Very strange.
And say, it's him.
Yeah.
You hear stories about this, about people saying that they saw somebody in a room or whatever it might have been and said, it's always going to be that person. And it's not creepy. It just happens to be this. It's more cosmic than creepy.
It is, yeah. It's very strange. And your conscious mind comes in and says, well, you know, you need to just calm down now. It's just, you're in one city, he's in another, he's in a relationship, you're in a relationship. But it did. It came around and we're together for, 32 years?
I suppose in some ways, and this is an unusual turn on the road, we have to talk about Ronan's father.
Yes.
Again, a theatre producer. In the programme I was watching from before, it's an older programme where Grace Kelly's come to town and he's bringing her in to the press car. So he was mixing, brushing shoulders with these kind of people. Anyway, Ronan's father got ill. At some point in his life, which I'm going to ask you about now, but he didn't want to tell anyone.
That's right.
And he was hiding in plain sight.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Well, I didn't know Brendan personally. I met him once when he was very, very ill, about 6 months before he died. He did hide it. And I think he wasn't just hiding it from other people. I actually think he might have been in denial himself because it's such a distressing disease that part of you doesn't want to face it. So it was Ronan, it was Michael Colgan actually who worked with him, who worked with Brendan in. Brendan founded the theatre festival.
Yeah.
So Michael called Ronan and said, look, things are not good here at all. There's something really wrong with
his
your
father.
Dad. And so the world really came tumbling down, and they went down the road of looking for care. And they finally got him care in Donnybrook in St. Mary's.
And it was Alzheimer's we're talking about.
It was Alzheimer's and a particular type of Alzheimer's, Ryan. Ronan has what we call familial Alzheimer's disease, FAD for short. And only 1% of all dementias. There are around 110 types of dementia. 1% of them are FAD. It's quite a rare gene. And the peculiar thing about FAD is you get ill exactly, almost to the day that your father got sick.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, or your mother.
What was what was Ronan's father doing that was, I know you didn't mean it, that was the cover-up bit that people were saying, what's that carrying on?
He was terribly confused in the office, files all over the place. His cognition was just descending. He was, going around Europe on trips because of the festival, getting lost in Paris. Chaos, really.
And what you can see and read from the book that Ronan has written with Sue Leonard is the sense that at the time, I wonder about the 1980s, mid to late 80s, when I think Ronan appeared on The Late Late Show.
Yeah, he appeared with Gay, would have been about 88, actually.
To talk about his father and Alzheimer's.
Yes.
But I think it was quite
89.
Interesting. Here we are in 2021.
I know.
Talking about
so
that
strange.
And how it was taboo almost, Alzheimer's. That it
oh,
was,
absolutely.
I didn't realise it was, yes. It was kind of so undiscussed.
Yes, and the ASI, the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, wasn't long in existence. And in fact, Ronan was part of that team. He joined the ASI when his father got sick, and he was a great help to them as a lawyer and everything else. But and here we are again, come full circle. It's very strange.
So talk to me then a little bit about Ronan and how, I mean, he seems like a very charismatic guy.
He is very charismatic.
Theatre guy.
Yeah, he's still very charismatic.
Yeah.
He started life out as a child actor from the age of about 10.
Black Beauty.
And then did some teenage acting, early adult acting, like SOS Titanic with Helen Mirren, his bestie, as he likes to call her. Lee Remick, who he still has a crush on, even though she's probably passed. But anyway, we won't go into that. He loved all that. And then he went on to be a stage actor in Dublin with the Gate and the Abbey Theatre, and then became artistic director of Team Theatre Company while acting at the same time and producing at the same time. So quite often Ronan would be working from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, which is not a great thing. And it is a theme in the book.
Yes.
Workaholism is a theme. And I think it's something that we kind of possibly need to really talk about more in society.
Separate to where we're going with Alzheimer's, do you think it's another issue altogether?
It's another issue.
Yeah.
It's not for today, but it is a...
It's a very good point you make.
It's as important as other isms like alcoholism. And the common denominator is that you leave behind, you leave an absence in the people around you.
Yes.
For the people around you.
Do you think some workaholics are on the run?
Possibly they're on the run from themselves.
That's kind of what I was thinking of.
Alcoholics are on the run from themselves.
Yeah, a lot of people on the run are...
eating disorders are on the run from themselves.
Yeah, good point, yes.
And so it is a psychological thing, yeah.
We'll come back to Ronan, though, if you don't mind,
and
ask you about the point in his life, at what age he was, when you started thinking, Miriam, this isn't good.
He was about 57.
That's young, yeah.
We were on holidays with our dear friend Philip and Una in Clavier in France. And it's just something very tiny, but I just really got very suspicious. I sent him to the shops for two items and he came back with one, and he repeated the same the next day. And I remember saying it to Philip and Una, and they thought I might be imagining things. But anyway, it just progressed from there and I became quite suspicious. And he did become quite stressed at home. And then he went to work on a job that he wasn't. It wasn't the theatre world. It was the Science Gallery attached to TCD.
Yes.
And that's where he really felt things were falling apart for him.
Was he able to articulate that?
Not to me. But in his diaries, he expressed how he was finding it hard to cope, And I encouraged him then to be tested for Alzheimer's.
Yes.
So we went to the memory clinic, had the testing done, and then we were called back to be told.
It's not good.
It's not good, no. Early onset Alzheimer's disease was the diagnosis.
Draw this box. Remember these words. These are the sort of some of the tests that you have to, apply in this case.
Yes, and memory.
And memory, of course.
And recall.
The shuffling of the papers, you mentioned his father, Ronan's father's files and everything. I got the sense this was history repeating itself again.
Very much so. Very much so. Ronan felt, actually, he was on the floor in the science gallery with papers. And he thought, oh my God, I'm actually repeating history. This is what I spoke about my father. So,
and the sense of cover up, of trying to not let other people know where you were at. Did Ronan have the same problem?
No, not at all.
Yeah,
not at all. Ronan was terribly brave. He came out immediately. He told his boss. He was working for Caroline Downey in the Gaiety at the time, and he went to Caroline and told her, and she was very, very supportive. Moya and John in Riverdance, very supportive. And it's not the case for all employers.
Yeah,
you know,
very good point again.
Getting that news.
Yes.
No, he never hid it, no. And we told the children, we told Lachlan after his leaving cert. We wanted that to be done, yeah.
And then
Hannah found out. She was in college and she found a book in my bag called Emotional Something Dementia. Contented Dementia.
Yeah.
She found it in my bag. She was looking for my phone and she was in the kitchen with me. And she took the book out of the bag and she looked at it and she said, what's this about? And I nearly collapsed. And I said, oh, that's just some research I'm doing for Samaritans, because I was working with Samaritans at the time. And she said, no, it's not.
Yeah.
And she just collapsed.
She knew. She knew. Did she know about her grandfather's story? And
Yeah.
Yeah. I get the sense that you feel like you wish that book hadn't been there in that bag at that time.
Yeah, I suppose she had to know sometimes.
Of course she did, yeah. I hope you're not being hard on yourself, though. You were...
No,
it's not
just
fair. You say, Miriam, I spend a lot of time trying to protect him, Ronan, from his own sadness.
Yes.
And I have to accept I can't do that. What do you mean by trying to protect him from his own sadness?
I think a researcher asked me, it was Donal Lynch, actually, a writer, what was the worst aspect of this? And I said to him, it's not to do with the coping on a day-to-day level, the practicalities. But when I see him really sad, I just want to, I just want to reach into his soul and take it out and make him happy. And that's a challenge for me because I know I can't do that and I'm working on that. And I think it's probably a huge challenge for most of us as carers. When I say carers, I mean spouses, children, husbands and wives who are caring for their loved ones. And I'm really realising what it must be like to live with somebody who's very depressed.
Mm.
That must be
incredibly
hard.
The intensity of it.
The intensity and the lack of control.
Did Ronan see his grip on reality and memory and all of these things slide away? Or was he aware? Was he kind of going...
Totally aware.
Like going in a lift, going there's
totally,
that floor,
he's
there's
still
that floor.
Aware. He's still aware. And that's very cruel.
Is it? Yeah, it must be.
It's very cruel because sometimes I wish he wasn't aware.
Yeah, I understand that.
You know, that he was on the other side, but he goes in and out of awareness. And
so flashes of lucidity, is that
it? Yeah. And like he gets very, very down and depressed and agitated.
Yeah.
And when he gets agitated, he knows there's something really wrong. Like he could walk around the house for ages and just be very confused. And that does agitate him to the point of tears. So he knows something is really wrong.
Does he ask you about it?
No, he can't verbalise very much anymore. His language has depleted. I try and sit with him and stroke his hand when he's like that. And he doesn't ask me about it. I ask him.
Do you? What do you ask?
Can you just give me one word, what you're feeling?
Okay.
Can you tell me? He usually can't, but I know him so well. I know what he's feeling.
You can see it in him.
Oh, I can see it in his eyes, yeah.
Is it a lonely road, Miriam?
It's extremely lonely. Yeah. It is extremely lonely. But I do have amazing neighbours and friends. And I would say to anybody who is embarking on this journey, not to panic.
The analogy you use of the flight, you know, that Ronan was nervous getting on a plane. And
that I was nervous. I'm a nervous passenger.
You were the...
And getting on the plane and being told by the pilot in a very calm voice, we're now taking off. I would just like to announce we will be on a very long trip together. There will be turbulence. But at the end of the flight, we will crash. And that's just a vision I had the day of the diagnosis at 4 a.m. That's how I was describing it to myself.
Yeah.
There is a crash at the end, but I would say to people embarking on the journey, try not to think about that. Live in the moment. Get as much help as you can. Go to the right doctors. Go to a geriatrician. Mm. Go to people who are expert in dementia. Not a GP. GPs are great,
but
you must have somebody like a geriatrician to have your back.
Do you have to think about the reality of not living physically with Ronan in terms of the house and maybe getting better care? Is that the hardest part of your day, thinking of that? Or is that just, have you come to an acceptance on that?
No, I haven't.
And are we talking about finding a proper residence for him? Is that what you're thinking of?
Yes, and I have begun the journey of looking for places, because I think one should do that before a crisis happens.
And how are you doing with that?
Okay. I'm trying to be very practical about it.
Yeah.
I did go to see one 2 weeks ago, and I did find it very upsetting and depressing. I mean, they were terribly nice, but... the age profile was not Ronan.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking around, it was quite depressing.
You feel he should be among people.
He's just so young and, yeah.
And can I ask you about, we've talked a lot about how difficult it is and how sad it is. Does Ronan have any lucid moments of great joy and
Yes, he's
happiness?
Amazing.
And
yeah.
Can you talk to me a little bit about
that? My number one tool for that, for accessing that joy, is I thought long and hard about what would help his cognitive health when he got sick. So I bought him a ping pong set. So we play table tennis every day together.
Do you?
I invite neighbours and friends to come in and play table tennis with him. And he changes... completely.
Get away.
You can actually almost see
physically
the cortisone leaving the adrenal gland up into the brain, and he's smiling and he becomes Ronan the old actor.
Really?
Yeah. Even verbally he's different.
And do you think he's putting on a show?
He is putting on a show, but that is as much a part of him.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, because that he was that person. He was very gregarious, fun-loving, charming, very funny, very witty. And that's what comes out with the ping pong.
Isn't it amazing? It's
extraordinary to watch.
And reassuring, or heartening at least.
It's very heartening for me, and it's a support to me to see that.
One of your neighbours just contacted us to say that...
oh my goodness.
Yeah, Miriam and Ronan are beyond impressive in the way they're dealing with this tragic disease, and they're truly inspiring. So the ping pong...
is there a name?
It's just from a neighbour, so they're being discreet.
Well, thank you. But, thank you so much, whoever you are.
The support and appreciation. Now, Karen McDonald was on to say, like others who are probably listening to your interview with Miriam, I have happy memories of the later days at the Brendan Smith Academy of both Ronan's parents. And Ronan, of course, a lovely, kind man. Best wishes to him and to Miriam. If it's not too intrusive, how are your children and how are they with Ronan? And is it, obviously it's all changed, but is there beauty there or is it sadness? How would you describe that?
Both. Mm. Both. They're both terrific people. Hannah's 28 and Lachlan is 25. They're really just quite exceptional people. They're very empathetic. Lovely. So I think it is very hard for them to visit our home every week because they can see a change weekly. They both live separately. They're both independent. Sure. Whereas for me, I'm seeing it on a daily basis. And it must be very difficult for them to come home every week and see the changes. But they just get on with life and try and support me as much as they can and their dad. They play table tennis or whatever needs to be done, yeah. Go for a walk.
Is there music he likes?
Oh, yeah. I play. I my lovely son, Lockie, got me Alexa last year. So it means I can access music very quickly for Ronan. So he loves jazz and blues and B.B. King, Benny King, Solomon Burke.
Excellent taste.
Yes, indeed.
And that puts a little light in the fire in the eyes then when you hear.
Absolutely.
I believe music is very, very helpful.
It's very helpful. Very, very helpful. Yeah. And our wedding song was Stand By Me with Benny King.
Was it?
And I can play that anytime in the kitchen and dance with him around the kitchen and he remembers. So that's really nice.
That must be kind of a sort of...
bittersweet.
Yeah, that's it.
It is.
Dancing in the kitchen.
It is,
like
but
that.
You have to keep going.
Miriam and Ronan, can you ask if she's tried singing with them, with both using song sheets to sing from? Celine in Dublin wants to know.
Yes, I have.
There you go. That's interesting.
I'm in a choir.
So
lovely Diva Voce's choir.
Oh, gorgeous. And I'd say that's good for you too. That's to have that support. Thank you for the beautiful interview, Miriam. I buried my dad last summer and several years of bad health and dementia. 3 months later, my vibrant mum was diagnosed. Apart from the fear, it's my fate. It's so difficult coping day to day with the mad fluctuations of mood and health, says Marina. And another is listening to Miriam this morning, thinking about her. And as there, a lot of people have their own stories and they're making them a connection with you and saying, well, we had something similar. You're being minded, right? You've got friends, as you say, and
yes,
neighbours.
Very good friends.
And yet I feel this, quite a strong solitary sense to your...
Yeah, it's deeply lonely, existentially lonely.
Yeah, you're very honest about that.
Yeah.
Because
there's no getting away from it.
Yeah. I think it's more healthy to be brutally honest about it rather than...
Absolutely.
Because if somebody was listening in feeling very lonely and heard you saying, oh, it's grand of neighbours and we play ping pong, it's great.
No.
So how are you feeling about the immediate future?
Scared, really scared. Yeah, I'm absolutely terrified.
What do you do to try and alleviate some of that fear, the loneliness?
I go into my garden.
Yeah,
I have
your church.
That's my church, yes. I heard you speaking earlier about mountains. I'm in the foothills of mountains. I have mountains at my back and I have a lake in front of me.
Yes.
So we're very, very privileged to have that. And I'm a huge lover of nature and I spend a lot of my time outdoors. So I go kayaking on the lake with Ronan and hill walk. And
It's the redemptive power of nature.
It is.
I understand.
It's my saviour, actually.
My long may it save you.
Yes.
Miriam, thank you for coming in to talk
to
us today.
Welcome.
Please pass on our love to Ronan.
Thank you
and
so
to your
much.
Children.
Thank you.
And your book is called, If Memories, not your book, obviously, but Ronan's book with Sue Leonard is called If Memory Serves Me Wrong, a memoir of theatre, love and loss to early onset Alzheimer's. I think the amount of people in this country who will be able to relate to that book and this story is phenomenal, and I think it'll be if not a salve, at least a great help to people to be able to read this and
say,
they'll feel a little less alone when they read this.
Thank you.
It's been lovely to meet you, Miriam.
You too, Ryan.
Hopefully, happier circumstances next
time. Yes, indeed.
But I'd love to stay in touch if you don't mind. We'd like to keep following your story and make
sure
that all is well. And
yeah.
I look forward to hearing your, progress and happiness eventually coming your ways. You deserve it. And keep dancing in that kitchen.
I will, indeed.
Okay. See you soon.
Take care.
Thank you kindly.
Bye.
It's 9 minutes to 10. Right then, it's 9:27. And I want to introduce you to Mr. Clive Clark. Good morning, Clive.
Good morning, Ryan.
Nice to talk to you. How are you doing today?
Oh, very well, thank you.
For people who haven't got your back catalogue to hand, will you remind us of how we would know you from watching you in the sporting field?
I played for Ireland, obviously, at every level, and then I played in England for Stoke City, West Ham, Sunderland and Leicester City.
So your credentials are impeccable, Clive, let's face it. And you were at a barbecue last Saturday evening watching a particular match that had become very famous, a little bit infamous. Tell me what you thought when you were seeing what was happening with Christian Eriksen on the pitch.
Yeah, obviously we went around to a friend's house to watch the game and seeing the incident sort of unravel, and the first reaction was he's had the same as I had. Just the collapse like that on the field, you think straight away. Well, I think straight away it's obviously very serious, and it was a cardiac arrest.
And you had you probably had a little bit of a trigger yourself, going, "I was that soldier."
Yeah, no, definitely. It's like I've kind of lived that. What he's gone through, what he went through then, and what he's going through now. I've experienced it. I didn't do it on the football field, but I done it at halftime. But it was in the game scenario, and thankfully for him and for me, I think that's probably one of the safest places to have a cardiac arrest.
Of course. We go back to your story then, if you don't mind, Clive, to 2007.
Yeah, I was a Sunderland player, but I was on loan at Leicester City. Mm-hmm. And I'd just gone there on loan, as you do in football sometimes. I fell out with Mr. Roy Keane at Sunderland. Wouldn't be the first one. Went to Leicester City on loan, and it was a Tuesday night playing against Nottingham Forest, which is a big East Midlands derby game in England. And at half time, I was walking off the field. Didn't feel particularly great, but just thought a bit lethargic or whatever. Sat down at a bottle of water. Manager speaking to me, not really registering anything he's saying. And next thing I know is that I've woke up in the back of an ambulance after having a cardiac arrest, which was obviously very frightening for everyone. Except me, because obviously I was KO'd.
Well, that's the fascinating thing. As you say, you're knocked out, so you're not aware of the storm. That you're in the eye of the storm. You don't know what's happening around you until you're told afterwards. Your heart stopped, did it?
Yeah, my heart stopped for 4 minutes. So it was like, obviously, you know, like a collapse. I banged my head off the floor, just sort of fell forward. And obviously all my teammates are in the changing room. I'm lucky enough that, you know, the physio at Leicester City, he's just recently left Leicester City, Dave Rennie, reacted really quickly. And there was an A&E doctor who was working for Nottingham Forest on the evening, which was very thankful as well, because GPs don't have to deal with this on a daily basis, where obviously an A&E doctor does, and obviously much more confident in that scenario. They reacted. They got me going on the fourth goal of the defibrillator, which was they were struggling to revive me, and it was very worrying times for them. But luckily enough, I think it was on the third one, they got me going for a few seconds, and then on the fourth one, they actually got me going properly with a bit of adrenaline, I think. And you know, thankfully, like recovered quite well, but my heart stopped for 4 minutes at that time.
I'm not a medical person, Clive, but 4 minutes strikes me as a long time to have no heartbeat. What did they tell you about that?
Yeah, I think for every minute that your heart stops, it brings up much more more problems, you know, with other organ failure, and obviously the blood flow to your brain and things like that. So, you know, to walk away relatively all right after it is was a very lucky boy.
You got the four goes on the defibrillator. And just to put it into context, Christian Eriksen had how many goes?
I think it was one for Christian, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, so that would illustrate the gravity of your situation. Tell me...
It was pretty bad.
Tell me about waking up in the ambulance, though, and looking around. I mean, you would have been probably still in your kit.
I was still in my kit, yeah. Obviously, I had my jersey sliced all the way through the middle. But I obviously still had my socks and shorts and everything else on. And I woke up, and my head was a bit sore, my chest was sore, they broke a rib doing CPR on me that night. So I woke up, obviously, with a sore rib and a sore head. And then looking down, I was like, obviously, try and take it all in, and one of the paramedics, obviously, in the back of the ambulance talking to me a little bit, and, you know, took a few minutes for everything to register.
Your wife got a phone call in the middle of it all.
Yeah, obviously my wife, I had a house up in the northeast, and I just literally come down to the Midlands, and we were staying with her mum and dad, and she got a phone call, and we only had a 9-month, 10-month-old baby at the time as well, so we were staying with me in-laws, and she gets a phone call to say, look, at you know, things aren't looking great for Clive. Because obviously I'm in the changing room, only with the doctors and medical team, and the manager and the CEO and everyone of Leicester, they're all on the football field and my teammates. So she gets a phone call saying, look, essentially, you know, Clive might have passed away. Which is obviously, horrendous news for her.
That is quite a shocking. Somebody kind of jumped the gun, to say the least. How does she respond to that?
Well, I think after the third go, one of the guys who was in the room walked out and told the manager, saying, look, it's not looking good. And then obviously that news was sort of relayed back to someone who then, you know, wanted to be, I think he wanted to get in touch with my wife before broken the news, because obviously because it was a live game, stuff was happening on Sky Sports News and things like that. And, you know, there was no, you know, social media as much as it is today. So I think he just wanted to get in touch with her and sort of break the news as such, which was, he just said, look, it's not looking great. And then thankfully they rang her back saying, look, he's come around.
God, well, your poor wife. That's shocking. I mean, I'm sorry for you too, but I just, to be told that and hanging on a thread, wondering what the hell's going on.
Yeah, no, it was obviously very distressing for everyone at the time. You know, obviously my family back in Wicklow, they were obviously all worried, and I managed to be able to speak to them first. To be fair, my brother and my father were ringing, and finally got in touch with me. I spoke to them when I came around when I was in the A&E critical care bit.
When you got surgery, then of course, what did they do to you? What do after? And you have to remind me, of course, what age you were at the time, Clive.
Yeah, I was 27. You know, obviously meant to be coming into my prime as a footballer. You know, played hundreds of games, like back home in Ireland. Obviously played a lot of Gaelic football with Wicklow, and obviously played, you know, a lot of football matches, obviously soccer matches over there as well. And then obviously I played nearly 300 games as a professional. So I played like thousands of games in my life, and then to wake up at 27, being told you've had a cardiac arrest. They done all these testing. I was in hospital for 10 days, and they done every test under the sun.
Yeah.
And found that my heart was actually, you know, the fittest they've ever come across. And they actually had to take me off the monitors at night because of the alarm, because your resting heartbeat goes off at 30 beats a minute. My resting heartbeat was lower than 30 when I was asleep. So they had to take the alarm monitors off me, monitors.
Really?
So I've done every test under the sun as they could do then. And they came back that they couldn't actually pinpoint any heart condition. Other than obviously they knew my heart went into a rhythm that obviously stopped the bottom chamber of my heart from pumping blood. So I had to be, they gave me an internal defibrillator and implanted in my chest.
Amazing.
So I had that surgery while, I think it was like on the 8th day or whatever, after my, after my cardiac arrest, and obviously in the meantime being told that, you know, you'd never play football again. So it was mixed emotions for everyone.
You had a kind of physical shock to the system, and including a defibrillator now in your, which is, I suppose, what that sends an electric shock to your heart whenever it stops or something like that. And
yeah.
That's one thing. But then you had the psychological horror show of being told it's over. 27 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, you were on the cusp of such greatness as well. You were in the middle of greatness, but you had more to come.
Yeah, like obviously, hopefully, it was only halfway through my career, and you know, it was hard to take that, because all I ever wanted to do was be a footballer. You know, anyone would tell you, see me growing up, all you ever see me was with a football, going up and down the road, and you know, it was really hard to take, and it was such a mixed emotions, because obviously, you know, I've got a kid, 9 months, 10 months old, a little girl, obviously. It was me everything at the time, and well, still is. But you know, then be told that you can't play football. It was like, you know, it was such a mix of emotions. So you're very relieved and thankful on one side, but then, you know, you're good, and then you start worrying, because obviously that was my form of income, and you know, we weren't paid the same as the players are today. So, you know, yeah, you earned a really good living, but you know, you're only 27. You've got a long life to live. I couldn't live off the money I made. So I had to then start thinking, what am I going to do? Because obviously you come out of England at 16, not really got an education or anything either. So there's a lot of worry behind the scenes, but a lot of, you know, thankful sort of to everyone that helped me be here today.
There are a couple of things I wanted to ask you about. One of them was, there was a piece in the Irish Mirror talking about Conor Murphy, Irish soccer player, had a similar ordeal, and it was revived by his teammates after cardiac arrest during a game. And he talked about just what you said there a minute ago, that he wasn't aware of the trauma that was happening because it was going on to him and he was out of kind of KO'd, as you say. But the people around him who saw it, like the teammates you saw on the pitch on Saturday, and I don't know if your teammates talked to you about it afterwards, they were quite traumatised by what was happening in front of their eyes. Does that make sense? That
I think it's a massive shock to the system, and I think, you know, I'm not a huge fan of UEFA, but I think the idea of telling them they had to play on that evening or the next day was absolutely disgraceful.
Yeah.
You know, it just shows you, like, you know, money comes into every scenario. But me personally, my teammate, like Leicester, when I went to Leicester City, they were a good side. They had lots of new players, talented players. They end up getting relegated at the end of that season. People don't see that. Fabrice and Mumba, so the two of us are probably the two who survived that similar scenario to Ericsson in the last 15 years, whatever. Bolton got relegated that season as well. So, you know, the mental traumas, the players must be a massive effect to my teammates. Obviously, I wasn't lucky enough to kick a ball again, but it must be very hard for them to push themselves to the limit, because people don't realise that, you know, they're quick to say players are overpaid, this, that, and the other, but they are physical specimens. They do work extremely hard and day in, day out. And, you know, it's very demanding, the English football is. So there's a lot of games that you play, but play more games in England than any other country. And the demands on the body are huge.
The because I was kind of watching it from, obviously, from a distance. I wouldn't have the same expertise that you would have, Clive, but I got the sense that the spin on it was that Ericsson himself had kind of given the thumbs up to the game going ahead, that the two teams were asked, do you want to? And they said yes, as opposed to anyone with a gun to the head. Would that be fair to say?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, they weren't going to sleep that night, so I think they just wanted the game out of the way more than wanting to play. I think, you know, they knew full well that, you know, they didn't want to go out the next day, prepare all over, you know, bearing in mind they knew he was up and well, but they didn't know the full extent of things at that time, because they wouldn't have. They would have just been hearing a little bit back from the medical team, but they wouldn't have known the full extent, because obviously they wouldn't have ran any tests on him, you know, that an hour after the game. By the time he went to the hospital and got stabilised and all, they wouldn't be running any tests, that many tests. So I just think it was wrong for them to play the game. It should have been done at a later stage in the tournament.
Yeah, it all felt quite hasty, but, and you'd know, so I'll take your word on that. Has your heart stopped since?
Yes, I was a... Well, it didn't quite stop. I was in hospital again. I was in Ireland. I was at the Curragh racetrack. I used to buy and sell horses, and I love, like, horse racing and the breeding side of horse racing. So I was at the Curragh one day at the sales, and we were, you know, we were just walking around, me and my friends, and you know, my trainer, Fozzie Stack, down in down Tipperary, and we were all at the sales, wandering around, whatever, and the machine went off. And to be honest, I thought it was a horse kicking me in the back, because it had never gone off before. And that's the kind of impact you have, because obviously, you know, you get an electric shock internally. But it was like it was sort of in my back. And I turned around, thought a horse had kicked me, and I didn't collapse, because apparently sometimes you're meant to collapse if your device goes off. But I didn't, and it took a couple of minutes for me to realise what exactly went on. And then I started panicking a little bit, so I got my... my friend who was with me, I was staying in Ireland at the time, so I had my car there. So we drove to St. Vincent's, and I went into the A&E there. My wife was over with me, so she met me at the hospital, and they took me to A&E, and then they quickly moved me up to the cardiac risk unit, because of, you know, my heart was so irregular. It was all over the place. So obviously, you know, it was still, this is about 2.5 years after my initial cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
We ended up in St. Vincent's for 3 or 4 days.
It is amazing, Clive, that we're talking today largely on foot of what happened at a football tournament on Saturday and what happened to Christian Eriksen, because what you're talking about and your own story is so important for Irish people to be listening to today, including myself, because we need to look after our hearts.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, like sometimes, you know, you can be the fittest person as well, you know, and that's why you need to have defibrillators locally,
yeah,
definitely around every sport and venue, you know, whether it's amateur, professional, semi-pro, whatever it may be, you know, and that's for every sport and event. You know, we love our sport in Ireland, and, you know, I think people are fitter now in Ireland than probably ever been, you know. We'll go home forever seeing people running and out walking and everything else. So, no, it is very important to look after our heart, but it's also important that we have the right medical training, you know, so if someone does collapse the side, like someone around them do know CPR, and, you know, having the defibrillator locally, which, to be fair, over the last, you know, 14 years since my one, going back home, I see a big improvement on that side of, you know, when I do go to a sporting event or, you know, in a town or whatever, I do see quite a lot of defibrillators locally. So, you know, I think the awareness is happening over there, but I think it needs to get better and better.
The Matter Heart Foundation do tremendous work in this regard.
They're brilliant. I'm one of eight kids, and obviously what happened to me was in England, but obviously all my family are in Ireland, and the Matter Foundation went and tested all my family, because obviously, you know, we're doing all the heart trace and all the tracking, took these tests of, there's a thing called long QT, which is like a long heartbeat, which, you know, I've got one of them. I haven't actually been diagnosed with long QT, but I have a sort of an extra heartbeat, and then I have a time when my sort of heart skips a beat.
Yeah.
And they done all that testing for my family, and they were absolutely brilliant. It's a fantastic foundation.
Yeah. And, you know, Michael from Carlow was on to say it. At the age of 29, my heart stopped for 4 days after open heart surgery for a leaking valve. I was down for 12 minutes, and thankfully they got me back. I was in the right place at the right time, but it was traumatic, not just for myself, but for my family. I mean, 4 minutes I thought was a lifetime, but 12 is another prospect altogether. But people echoing what you're saying this morning, Clive.
That's brilliant. And, you know, the reason why I'm doing sort of radio interviews is to raise awareness, because, you know, not everyone's as lucky as myself and Christian Harrison to be surrounded by all the medical staff and, you know, have the defibrillators right on hand, and people who know how to use them, and people who know to do CPR and all that. You know, it's important that awareness is raised.
What part of Wicklow are you from?
I'm from Newtown, Mount Kennedy.
Oh, sure, not well. And do you get back home much?
I do, yeah. Well, obviously, in the last year, it's been very difficult. But, yeah, I always get home for the summer with the kids, and then try and get back 3 or 4 times during the rest of the year. So, yeah, try and spend as much time as we can.
OK, and in terms of career then, you went from 27-year-old being told it's over. I presume you had to regroup emotionally and mentally to try and face the next chapter. Can I ask you what you decided to head for? You mentioned horses at one stage.
Yeah, well, I had a horse racing business as well, which was, that was more a bit of fun with friends and all. And we'd be lucky, we had some really good horses down with Tommy and Fuzzy Stack down to Tipperary. You're great people. I moved back to Ireland for 9 months, sort of not knowing what to do with myself. And then the guy who represented me, at the time my agents weren't big, and I went and worked at a law firm back in England. Didn't know whether to go and try and do a law degree or do something else in sport. Started doing the coaching badges and everything. Then they had a sports agency, so I ended up working for them. And I've been working as a sports agent for the last 12 years or so.
A very important job. People need to be minded, as you know.
Try and look after them and, you know, make sure that they understand that the career doesn't go on forever, and, you know, try and give them the best possible advice. And it's a hard industry, because when you're 18, you don't want to listen to, you know, think about the, you know, what might happen after your career, and all I think, if they're going to play for Man United and earn the same money as Paul Pogba or whoever, you know. So it can be tricky at times, but you need to be aware that, yeah, that's brilliant, but you also got to think of the other things and after football and what you're going to do as a career and everything, because I know full well that it can stop at any moment.
You did something that very few people listening to this program will have done, which is you fell out with Roy Keane. What happened?
To be honest, it was sort of, we made a mountain out of nothing, really. It was, we played away at Stoke, which is my old team. I played most of my football at Stoke City, and my wife had just given birth to her first child. So we played Stoke on a Tuesday, Wednesday evening. And as I was finished the game, came out of the the changing room, load of the staff who were at the club gave me, you know, little baby gifts and things like that for for my wife and all. So it was really nice. I had about 6 or 7 bags. And like Tony Poulos, who's a Stoke manager, I think he gave us a few bits and bobs as well. So anyway, I got on the coach and he's like, oh, here he comes. Here's Mr. Stoke City, all his baby bags and all that. And he was obviously annoyed. We like actually lost the game. We played really well. We got beat last minute 2-1 with the game, which we should have won. So God, he was frustrated. And obviously I was frustrated. So he said something to me, like smart or whatever, and I'm one that can't bite my tongue, so I said something smart back to him. Anyway, the next day I gone in and he had me training with the reserves after praising me after the game for playing quite well. So I didn't take kindly to that, so I went and seen him and told him a few home truths, and I went to Coventry on loan about 4 days later.
All because of a few baby bags, Clive.
Yeah.
Who knew? Yeah. It could all have been so different. I'm glad to say, having met Roy Keane in the last couple of years, he's a new man. He's completely chilled out, Clive.
He's mellowed, yeah. I see him all the time.
Do you?
He can be frosty with us at first, because obviously I'm doing my job and he was doing his job as assistant manager as a manager and, you know, all that. And I run into him occasionally still. We just nod at each other and go our merry ways.
That's the way to do it. Yeah. I've enjoyed our conversation, Clive. Thank you so much for your time this morning. I wish you and your family well, and stay healthy, stay well.
And you, all the best. Thanks
nice
very
to
much.
Talk to you. Thank you very much. Clive Clark joining us on the phone. He's one of those, isn't he, one of those guys who left Newtown Man Kennedy and Wicklow, but he never changed his accent. I always think it's quite interesting that somebody spends so much time abroad that they just stay true to who they are. And what a story, what a salutary tale on the programme this morning at 11 minutes to 10. I mentioned how much I wanted to go and see the Book of Mormon. In fact, at one stage I booked it, had tickets and everything, and then something happened here that interview-wise that I couldn't make the trip over, which was a shame. I was very much looking forward to seeing it. And then, in the most Irish of exchanges, I got a text here to the programme, 51551, from Aoife, saying, Ryan, I've got to talk to my little brother, Cian McCarthy. He grew up in Cork and was musical director of The Book of Mormon on Broadway and played the very first live performance of the Hamilton music. So what? An Irishman did this? Well, it's true. And thanks to one very proud big sister, I'm now very happy to say good morning to this man, Cian McCarthy. Good morning, Cian.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm great. Where in the world are you and why?
I'm in Sydney, Australia. It's late in the evening, Sydney, Australia, and I'm here rehearsing the Australian production of Moulin Rouge, the musical, which is going to be opening down here in September. So I flew down here and quarantined, and here I am.
Well, I played a bit of Tony Bennett singing. It don't mean a thing if they ain't got that swing. And that music would be appropriate to you because we got to talk jazz. I'm not talking about jazz hands. I'm talking about your dad. I'm talking about Cork. I'm talking about jazz.
Yep.
So come on, talk to me a bit about jazz. Jeepers, like you're the guy who's been playing this and doing it.
It's a big subject.
It is a big subject. So let me ask you about the influence of this musical area in your life.
Well, I mean, I kind of grew up playing piano, you know, as a young kid, and, you know, mostly played classical, and my dad is actually a jazz drummer. And so I kind of grew up with jazz kind of all around me in the house. And so, you know, as I kind of got better at the piano and, you know, in my teenage years, started playing jazz and really got into that and ended up going to college in the US for jazz. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been like my passion for, you know, a number of years was writing and playing jazz. Well, unfortunately, there's not a huge living to be made these days in jazz. So, you know, I had to pay my bills in New York City. So ended up doing theater in New York. And that's how it all happened.
But just the idea of being a jazz musician in New York, it's so romantic and kind of art deco almost, you know. It's Gershwin, isn't it?
Yeah. It's fantastic. I mean, the amount of jazz clubs they have there, it's like a playground for a jazz musician. You know, you can go to Dizzy's or the Blue Note or the Iridium, and there's just jazz. You know, normally there's jazz playing every night of the week. Not right now, there's not, but normally there is.
You were very young when the big break happened. Will you tell me about that? What happened?
Well, I mean, I you know, went to college, like I said, in Boston, and then kind of moved to New York just to kind of see what would happen. And, you know, like I said, to be a jazz musician. And I ended up getting in touch with someone who was working on In the Heights, the Broadway musical, back when it was opening in 2008. And obviously, like, the movie is coming out now, so it's back in the zeitgeist. But yeah, I started working for In the Heights. He hired me to basically conduct the show and play keyboards for the show. And I worked on the show for about 3 years. And it was, you know, through meeting Lin-Manuel and meeting that whole team that worked on In the Heights that I sort of worked on the Hamilton, the first performance of, you know, the score to Hamilton basically was back in 2012 at Lincoln Center. And I played the keyboards for that and helped do some of the arranging for that as well.
Which is phenomenal. We need to pause there at that moment, because Hamilton is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I've never seen it on stage, unfortunately, because it kind of came into my life through when it went on the Disney thing. And it is just so remarkable. Lin-Manuel Miranda, the man who created that, and of course In the Heights, which is now the movie, seems to have this amazing brain in terms of lyrics and story and music, and there you are, an Irish guy from Cork, right in the thick of it. You know, seriously, if credit where it's due, and that opening, recording, and all the rest of it. Can you talk to me a little bit about the process of that? Because that music is so intense and so such a mix of styles and genre and so on. What was that like?
I mean, it was amazing. I mean, Lin is as every bit the genius that he seems. I mean, he really is. You know, when lyrically, I mean, I toured with Lin actually, and you know, we'd be out like, you know, after a show, and he'd be like beatboxing, you know, and rapping with like the rest of the cast. Like, he's always on, and so, you know, he has such like a wide, eclectic sense of style that for him it's just so easy to write, you know, a salsa musical and then a hip hop musical, and he's really like experienced and really knowledgeable about the history and the repertoire of hip hop. So it just was like, you know, it was amazing to be able to actually just, you know, sit down and be part of kind of the genesis of where the kind of string arrangements came from and how the keyboards would play and all of that kind of stuff. And he's so collaborative too. Like, he really is, you know, it's amazing actually just like sitting down and getting to work with him. And he's also just a lovely guy.
Really? So he's a good egg in the middle of it all.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's really, really wonderful. And even now to this day, as huge as he is, he's still a friend.
Nice to hear that. Both my girls are big fans of Hamilton, but my youngest was telling me this little thing about, a nugget of information about it, that in Hamilton, there's a moment where they're talking, there's a song the two lads are singing, and the line talks about immigrants get stuff done, or words to that effect. And because the applause that came with that line every night was so sustained and so big, they lost the effect of the next line. And the story goes that he had to put in a couple of beats just to add them so that they could take the applause. Is that true?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
That's amazing. I mean,
that has been my experience.
In the Heights is how would you describe that? Because that's coming into cinemas here quite soon.
I mean, In the Heights is a phenomenal show. Like, you know, it was written before Hamilton, and it's just a really, really amazing kind of heartwarming story about you know, an immigrant community in, you know, the northern part of Manhattan. And, you know, honestly, for me, it was a huge kind of part of my life, because I started working on the show when I was about 21, 22. And, you know, I just moved to New York, and, you know, being a relatively new immigrant to the U.S. as well, you know, the story of finding home and finding your place in the world. And it's really all about family, and like, whoever you're with, that's your family. And it really spoke to me, and it was just really amazing to be kind of welcomed as an Irishman, welcomed into that community. And it taught me so much about salsa and about, you know, that culture. It was really, really amazing. And I have such great memories. And so now that the movie's coming out, it's kind of going back down memory lane, watching the movie and hearing the score again. You know, it brings back some really, really amazing memories for me.
Because you're kind of ahead of its time in some regards. It was pre-Trump and, you know, his thoughts on immigrants and immigration, broadly speaking. It's a very joyful kind of post-pandemic, post-Trump celebration almost of difference.
Yeah. And honestly, it was also kind of like the first, you know, show that really included hip hop, I think, or one of the first shows that really included hip hop that became commercially successful. And the way he kind of blended, you know, the salsa styles with the hip hop and like pop music was like really, really amazing.
So when I go, if I go to a musical for that you're involved in, are you the guy, are you the conductor in the pit?
Sometimes I am. It depends on the show. So for the Book of Mormon, I was the conductor in the pit, and for In the Heights, I was the conductor in the pit for a long time. And on Moulin Rouge, the musical that was running on Broadway, I was the conductor in the pit on that show. Now I'm working more as kind of a supervising music director, if that makes sense, kind of helping set up the production and all in different countries around the world, and kind of helping people in those countries like learn how to do our show.
Now, can I ask you just briefly about being a conductor in the pit? Is it hot, sweaty, nasty, and cruel, or is it an adrenaline-fueled buzz?
Oh, it's very much the latter. It's fantastic. I mean, it can be hot, depending on the pit, depending on the teaser, depending on whether it's, you know, summer in New York or not. it can be warm. But, you know, normally they know that the musicians have to be down there 8 shows a week for hopefully years on end. So they usually do a good job of climate controlling it. But mostly it's just like, it's so much fun. Like the buzz of getting up on the podium and having the front row behind you, they get so excited just by seeing you. Yeah. And, you know, you get a buzz from just seeing their buzz. And then the show starts, and it's just such a thrill to get from the beginning to the end every night and kind of like experience the story live with the audience every night. It's amazing.
Okay, so you can treat every night differently rather than become numbed by the repetition, because that's often a thing I'm sure you're asked a lot. 8 shows a week, the same music over and over. Sometimes some musicians have to play this, you know, Phantom, whatever it is, for decades. And you'd wonder, God, that must be tough going. But you don't feel, but you're kind of more like a gun for hire. So you're on the move all the time. You don't quite have that same sense of brain numbing repetition.
Well, I did work as the conductor for the Book of Mormon for about 4 or 5 years on Broadway. So that was kind of a long run. But honestly, like, I think for the musicians, when the musicians are like, you know, are just in under the pit, it can get a bit, you know, night to night, it can get a bit dull and boring. But for the conductor, you know, the conductor is kind of like driving the bus, you know, and so he has to be on all the time, or he or she has to be on all the time, and has to also, you know, the cast that are on stage are changing things night to night. And so you have to, it is a different show every night. So for me, it always felt like exciting and different night to night, just because you never know, really know what's going to happen.
With what you're doing now, Moulin Rouge, for Baz Luhrmann, I mean, it was built for the stage. Clearly it's so out there and fun. The music, I remember the TV, the film, I should say, is a wonderful, colourful roller coaster for the eyes. What do you work with Baz Luhrmann? I mean, do you talk to him and to finesse things, or are you just left off on your own?
Well, in the development of the show, he was very, very involved, and we definitely talked a lot on, like, you know, the creation of the story, and you know, he was really amazing at kind of giving us the history behind why he made the decisions he made, you know, like why the Tang de Roxanne is in the movie, and you know, why, you know, just the kind of like different stories that really were really useful. But now that the show's open, you know, he's less involved. But we did work together very closely on making the cast album. And it was really amazing, you know, kind of being in the studio with him and seeing him work with actors and collaborating with him on really creating the sound of the records, like, was really, really amazing. And he's also a lovely guy, which is great.
Great, good. You know, there are, I think, more than 2,000 stage schools in Ireland. It is an enormous, you know, it is such an enormous hobby or interest. And for a lot of towns and villages around this country, and you know this, Cian, that it is, for some people, it is why they wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
And why do you think that is, in terms of people's excitement or attraction to it about the musical world?
I'd have to think about why am I attracted to it. I mean, I think it's just the thrill of live theatre, of kind of being, you know, walking into a room and sitting down and just be taken on a journey for a few hours. You know, it's like seeing a movie, but it's so much more invigorating and exciting, because you know it's really happening in front of you. And I think that you know, there's so much escapism in theatre that I think it really draws people to, you know, live performance just feels like a really thrilling, exciting thing, which it is.
And what's next for you now? Because you're obviously there with the Baz Luhrmann with the big in Australia. Will you stay there for a long time or?
I'm here until the show opens in end of August, early September, and then I go back. We're reopening the show in New York this autumn, and then there's going to be a production on the West End. I don't know if they've officially announced that yet, so I might be I might be leaking that information. But there'll be a production in the West End I think around opening in December, and then I'm working on a number of other very exciting projects that are in development that hopefully will be on Broadway in the next year or two. And so, you know, I'm happy to say that even though it's been a pretty quiet year up until recently in terms of the theatre industry, Things are kind of coming back with a bang, and everyone's really just like moving forward with creating new work. So it's really exciting.
Because when I head out to town or whatever, as it was at the weekend, and I saw just the excitement of people being in, it felt like a post-war scenario. And I think the word,
exactly.
You know the feeling, and the words that keep coming up are pent up. People have pent up energy and money and excitement. Not everyone, but most people that want to be out and about have that. And do you think that there's a pent up creativity that's going to drive a boom in theatre and musicals and the arts world?
Yeah, definitely. And honestly, probably what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of musicals about the pandemic in the next couple of years.
Oh, you know? No.
I think there's a lot of theater artists were sitting at home over the last year kind of thinking, well, what'll I do now? And like, well, maybe I'll write a musical about the pandemic. So I think definitely people, you know, there has been a lot of work going on. Like people are, they're not performing, but they're really using it as an opportunity to create. And so a lot of those ideas, I think, are going to explode in the next couple of years. And also probably more interesting and creative mediums. Like maybe it's not like, you know, a show on Broadway. Maybe it's like a hybrid. Maybe it's more in experimental. You know, maybe it's, you know, incorporating the virtual elements, you know, with Zoom and everything. There's a lot that people have learned over the last year that will change art, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Cian, you're tremendous at what you do, and congratulations. And we're very proud that we have an Irishman like yourself flying the flag wherever you might be at Broadway or beyond. So good luck with Moulin Rouge, and we'll see you back in Ireland whenever that happens. And we wish you well.
Cheers, Ryan. And actually, can I just say, because I think my niece and nephews would kill me if I didn't actually shout them out on the show, but Keelan, Fionn and Rory out in Ranelagh, they're great kids, and I just wanted to give them a shout out this morning.
Critical information, and you did the right thing. Good on you, Cian. Thanks for your time. Cian McCarthy joining us from Australia this morning, and Keelan and Fionn and Rory, we say hello to you too, listening in. And I know that Cian's family are very proud, and rightly so, and thanks to Cian's sister who got in touch with us in the first place. Aoife sent us that text to tell us all about that hidden gem, as I would describe him. But isn't he doing great work? You know, and there's other people like Killian Donnelly who I like to talk about, because he was with us on the Late Late Show not too long ago, and he's essentially been anointed by Andrew Lloyd Webber to be the Colm Wilkinson of this generation. And he is flying the flag, of course, on the West End as of August, I think it is. But it's just terrific to see the Irish on tour like that. So well done.